You're right. I think I know most of you, but anyway, I'm Joe Holland, the chair of the Palmerston Defence Heritage Advisory Group and chair of the Engineer Charitable Trust. It gives me great pleasure tonight to introduce a colleague, Honorary Captain, Naval,
yep.
Dr. Andrew McDonald, who's the official historian for the Royal New Zealand RSA. And Andrew has presented to us before, and I hope will become a regular contributor, albeit that he comes up from Wellington, but appreciate that. Anyway, without further ado, I'll hand over to Andrew, who's going to tell us a little bit about the Battle of Passchendaele in 1917 on the Western Front, and of course, the book that you wrote a few years ago.
So I guess, first of all, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming along tonight and hearing me out on the subject of Passchendaele. I'd like to acknowledge the people who've organised tonight's event, so Palmerston North City Council and City Libraries, of course, Councillor Mark Arnett, just took my glasses off, mate, I'm sorry, but thank you for coming along. Also to Joe Hollander, who has been most patient in his dealings with me via email over a wee while, but hey, it'll be all right on the night. So, all good. Before we get into the subject of Passchendaele in any kind of detail, I thought that I'd share with you a few words about my interest in the battle and where it came from, because I think that's part of the story, or at least my personal story, and it will help you see how I've interpreted the battle over the years. My journey began when I was about 10 years old. I'd had a long interest in my family's military history, 4 or 5 years at that stage. My grandfathers had served in the Second World War, great-grandfathers in the First World War, and there were a smattering of uncles and an auntie who was a nurse and is buried in Palmerston North, strangely enough. Among them were soldiers, sailors and aviators, some merchant sailors, and also one nurse that I've just touched on. However, at 10 years old, I really didn't know where my interest was going to go or if indeed it was a starter at all. And so, in 1984, this book popped up on the shelves in the various bookshops around the country called Gallipoli, The New Zealand Story, by the New Zealand military historian Chris Pugsley. For a young guy like me at 10 years old, that blew my socks off, that book, and so did the television documentary that followed it. There in front of me when I read that, the very idea that this is what I wanted to do for a living, I just had to figure out how to get there, which, you know, that's a separate story. Anyways, I spent the next few years reading pretty much everything that I could lay my hands on in terms of military history books. As any of the staff here and any author will attest, access to the book, to books and the knowledge that they contain is essential and is also a privilege that we must cherish and guard. On a military specific note, I don't know if you've seen the prices that those old books can fetch, but they are a massive cost barrier to anyone with an interest in taking up military history as a trade or a profession. Or indeed researching their relatives' endeavours in the field of battle somewhere in the world. My start was somewhat lucky. Hey Pat, how's it going? Where was I? I didn't have the budget with my milk run money to buy a library of military history books, but a local school, in a moment of wisdom, decided that it would throw out its entire library of First and Second World War official histories. And I can see myself now here as I talk to you all that I dived into the rubbish skip just as quickly as they were throwing them in. Fishing them out and stacking them and having to make 2 or 3 runs on my school bike to take them home. Well, I've still got every single one of those books, and I've read every single one of them from cover to cover. But I am pleased to say that nowadays my library has grown somewhat, and those books have been supplemented by one or two others via more traditional sources. So we'll just go on to slide number two. That's me on the left. That is a Gallipoli veteran called George Skerritt from Bluff. Anyway, these books that I've just been chirping on about here, they provided me with the knowledge base and the interest to go and talk to veterans about their military service. And so it was, as an 18-year-old, I decided that I would reach out to the local RSA and see if they could put me in touch with any old dukes at the local rest home that might spare a few minutes to talk to me. That put me in contact with Gallipoli veterans, others who had served at Armontier, at the Somme, at Passchendaele, at 30, and the 100-day offensive, among others. Anyway, I'm not going to canvass those interviews with a range of First World War veterans. They're kind of outside of our discussion, but I will mention one or two that may be of interest. One was an old guy called Bill Ramage. He was a recalcitrant, and he was permanently in trouble with the military authorities. As his personnel file showed. I enjoyed talking to the guy, as it was he was the last living member of Richard Travis Victoria Cross's troop that would cast raids into enemy territory. Not a permanent member, just a sometimes member. Anyway, Bill was wounded on the darkest day of New Zealand's military history, the Battle of First Passchendaele on the 12th of October 1917. He copped a bullet wound to his left ankle. Another old guy, and bear in mind, I was 18. These men were 96 at their youngest, and some were over 100. Gerald Beattie, he was from my hometown of Rangiora in the South Island, now twinned with Zonnebeke in Belgium. Well, Gerald survived unscathed that darkest day in New Zealand's military history, at least physically, but he suffered from the invisible wounds of war, for he saw several of his friends shot down and wounded or killed in very close proximity to him. Bert Stokes, another old guy from Onehunga, I saved up my newspaper and milk run money, I was quite enterprising in those days, to travel from Christchurch to Auckland to interview him. He had worked on the guns, supporting the infantry attacks, and as an old man he was indignant and in fact outright angry is a better description of his mood at the degradation that he and his fellow soldiers had suffered at the Battle of Passchendaele. Gordon Neal, and this is the last one that I'll mention tonight, became a close personal friend. If you ever walk through the Octagon in Dunedin, his optometry shop is still there under new management, but the brand is still there. Look, he was a friend, and he participated in the Battle of Broodseender on the 4th of October 1917. Gordon was wounded that day, as it happens, shot in the left arm with a bullet or a piece of shrapnel, but nonetheless summoned up the strength to cradle his fatally wounded company commander in his arms as he died. And Gordon would say to me that that officer, Neville Ardenne, no relation to the late Prime Minister, died with a sigh in my arms. Gordon knew something about the tragedy of war. His own brother was killed on the 12th of October and his body ultimately found and buried at Tyne Cot. He had also, in spite of his wounds, or perhaps because of, volunteered to be a stretcher bearer to carry wounded soldiers from the battle. So he'd felt the pain and he'd seen the suffering quite personally. That's Gordon Neal's brother, Jack Neal, with his child and wife. So you'll have heard now that I've thrown a bunch of names of First World War battles at you. Broodseender, Polkappel, First Passchendaele. Just to wrap these all in together in a nice little bundle, they were all constituent battles of what we call the Third Ypres Offensive, more commonly known as Third Ypres, or simply Passchendaele. As one Canadian soldier once wrote, "We died in hell. They called it Passchendaele." In any case, so it was that in the early 1990s through into the mid-1990s, I talked for hours and hours and hours with these oldest of elderly men. I would do it on the weekends, and I would wake school to do it during the week. School held no interest for me in those days. And often weekend after weekend after weekend. The longest series of interviews with First World War veterans I did was 3 years with a single veteran. So it was that in their living rooms and in their rest homes around Canterbury and to a certain extent Otago as well, I was trusted with the story of 3rd Ypres by the men who were there, the men who lived it, and the men who saw it up close and personal. I have heard their voices choke up, I have seen tears welling in their eyes, and I have seen the scars from First World War bullet and bomb on their arms and their legs and their abdomens. However, it wasn't all doom and gloom and misery. We did have a few laughs. We inevitably became sidetracked on any number of subjects. The All Blacks are usually good fodder for that. But perhaps most importantly, we bonded over endless cups of tea and on one or two choice occasions, an ice-cold beer drank from a big brown bottle in the sun. Cherished memories for me. So that's Gordon Neal, who I talked about before. So when I talk to you about 3rd Ypres for the next however long, little over half an hour or so, please do keep in mind that behind all of the scholarly endeavour, for me, at least personally, and I'm sure we've already had a gentleman here point out his family connection, are the faces and personalities and experiences of men that I knew. Of course, I've done a little bit of study and a little bit of writing in between times, as one does. So that's the first part of the talk, over and done with. I've gone over how I came to be interested in 3rd Ypres and why it means so much to me. Next, I'll give you a very brief overview of the New Zealand Division's part in the offensive, and then I'll outline the strategy behind the 3rd Ypres offensive from the perspective of Field Marshal Sir Douglas Haig. After that, I'll delve into the personality and character of Lieutenant General Sir Alexander Godley, before working through his influence on the battles of Broodsender, Polkapel, and First Passchendaele. Godley, for those of you who don't know, was the commander of the 2nd Anzac Corps, which included the famed New Zealand Division. Now, I'll wind up the talk with some comparative history. As it happens, within my family, I had relatives at Passchendaele with the New Zealand Division and also the Canadian Corps. And I'll close up with a word or two from a soldier, Gordon Neal, who was there in 1917. My talk tonight will not get mired down in the bullets and the bombs and the mud and the death and the destruction with first-hand anecdotal evidence. I'll give you an overview of it from an operational level so that perhaps you can understand how it came to be and how so many young New Zealand soldiers were wounded, injured or killed in the fighting. So, very briefly, that's Major General Sir Andrew Russell, the General Officer commanding the New Zealand Division for most of its time on the Western Front. Very briefly, the New Zealand Division was involved in the 3rd Ypres Offensive, which ran from July to November 1917. The division was commanded by the excellent Major General Russell, who we have here, and it had also participated in the necessary precursor battle that was the Battle of Messines in June 1917. As we've established, the division fought in a couple of the October battles of 3rd Ypres, being Broodsender and First Passchendaele. So, the Butcher's Bill, battle by numbers. At Broodsender, which had a successful outcome despite broken ground conditions, the division recorded a little short of 500 dead and 1,100 wounded. At First Passchendaele, the darkest day in New Zealand's military history, amid the black mud of Belgium, the division recorded 845 dead and about 1,900 wounded. But those are only the battles. Casualties were amassed throughout the month of October for the division. And if they're totted up, we arrive at a total of about 7,500. This including 1,500 roughly wounded, 1,500 dead roughly, 4,300 wounded, 230 missing, most of whom were dead, and 1,400-ish who were sick. Now, the word sick in First World War parlance is a little bit misleading, because it includes not only the usual gripes and grumbles of soldiers, such as blisters and toothache and bruises and sprains and all the knocks and bumps they will get, it also includes the invisible wounds of war, the shell shock, the nervous breakdowns, the post-traumatic stress. So when we talk about 1,400 soldiers sick, we really don't know what the underlying fabric of that number is. It must be noted there are a few different casualty figures for the New Zealand Division, but they're essentially all self-supporting. For the soldiers on the ground, what they knew is that it was darned lucky to escape from Passchendaele without physical wound. As Sergeant George McLaren of the Auckland Regiment said in after 30, "I'm darned lucky to be alive, but I can't really grumble. Over here, a man might have been pushing up cowslips lots of times, only for a terrible run of good luck." The semantics of that sentence have always interested me. A terrible run of good luck. I'd love to have been able to ask him what exactly he meant. So, moving on. Field Marshal Sir Douglas Haig, Commander of the British Army. So, everyone, we're moving at pace into the pith of this talk, and the question inevitably becomes, what did Field Marshal Haig want to achieve with the Third Ypres Offensive? Britain's strategy for Third Ypres extended far beyond the gentle rises of Passchendaele Ridge, which surrounded the Ypres salient that included the village, or the town of Ypres, and its famous cloth hall. His eyes were on the Belgian port towns of Zeebrugge and Ostend. We'll get to a map shortly. From which German naval forces operated. If left in German hands, these port towns represented a significant threat to Britain's ability to maintain its army on the Western Front, and also to keep the vital merchant supply line open to its ports. Moreover, the railway line that linked these two German-held port towns linked with a town called Roulur, just behind the Passchendaele Ridge. Now, this train line was a significant supply line to what the Germans called the Flanders Front. The broader British aim of the war, of course, was to forcibly eject the German army from Belgium and from France. All of this in mind, and with the opening of the annual summer campaigning season in 1917, Haig and the British government saw the securing of the Belgian coast, and that is the port towns of Zeebrugge and Ostend, as one of their priorities for 1917. Haig planned an amphibious operation combined with a series of land-based advances along the Belgian coast to open Ostend to the British army and hopefully force the Germans to evacuate Zeebrugge and eventually the whole Belgian coastline.
I think this is the map. So, can you all see that?
Yep.
A
simultaneous, and we're talking about the land-based operation here, up the Passchendaele Ridge, and we'll show that in another map just shortly, would bring that railway line that I referred to just a moment ago within the range of observers and therefore artillery guns, and ultimately, with hope, undermine the German army's position, forcing that withdrawal from Belgium. These factors were pivotal in the inception and governmental approval of Haig's planning for Third Ypres and gave the offensive a clear maritime dimension from the outset. It scarcely needs to be said, but for the record, these were a challenging set of strategic objectives that would take time and substantial resources to achieve. Let us not forget, too, the German army's painstaking development of these defensive positions on the Flanders front. This defence-in-depth network comprised multiple lines of developed trenches with interlocking machine guns crisscrossing no man's land and supported by an impressive weight of artillery. Early attempts under Haig's 5th Army, commanded by General Sir Hubert Gough, proved futile and costly. General Sir Hubert Plumer, now took charge and produced some promising victories in September 1917, such as at Menin Road and at Polygon Wood. In Haig's eyes, going into the month of October 1917, there was still very much on the table to be achieved in terms of strategic outcomes. Around this time, late September, early October, General Sir Henry Rawlinson, the commander of the British 4th Army, villain of the Somme, was told to make ready for the coastal and amphibious operation at the end of October. So this is a somewhat disjointed and spread out way of saying that the maritime and amphibious operation up the Belgian coastline towards Zeebrugge and Belgium was very much conditional on the land battles of Broodsender, Polkappel and First Passchendaele, and therefore on Godley and the New Zealand Division's ability to produce results on the ground in October 1917. Godley, Lieutenant General Sir Alexander Godley, Commander of the 2nd Anzac Corps. So, we're making good pace, and we're moving on with a little bit of gusto to Lieutenant General Sir Alexander Godley. Godley was the commander of the 2nd Anzac Corps, which included the New Zealand Division. It was he who cast a long shadow over the preparations for and implementation of the three early October battles of 3rd Eve. Just as a heads up, I've prepared this talk for a general audience rather than a technical and specialist military crowd. As the phrase goes, there's been a little simplification. In any case, if we get back to our man of the moment, Godley, he was a tall, slim, professional staff officer, educated in the British public school system in England, usually you find it there, and commissioned into the British Army afterwards. He had long service, including in New Zealand. More generally, Godley was of modest financial means and had no alternative career to the military. His social and his financial well-being were very much tied to the military and his career progression within that. People hold different opinions of Godley. People even hold different opinions of Godley to me. Bit of a surprise, but there we go. I just prefer to call him as he was, and that is ambitious and ruthless and not very good at winning battles at all. He was an astute careerist who sought to impress those in higher positions to gain career advantage and outshine those he perceived as rivals to promotion and therefore pay. Those at the bottom of the military food chain, and by that I mean our great and great-great-grandfathers and uncles, received only obligatory attention from Godley. As one Kiwi officer said of him, when he, Godley that is, liked, no one could be more gracious with an exquisite finish of manners. But as a rule, he appeared to the ordinary man, somewhat devoid of human sympathy, aloof, austere, and ambitious. Soldiers in the trenches loathe, and that's not too strong of a word, the man, and in the words of one that I spoke to, the boys, he said, didn't have much use for him. Such sentiments wouldn't have bothered Godley, though, for his attentions were a long way from what some ubiquitously grumbling soldiers said on some march or in some trench somewhere. Going into 3rd Eve, Godley was very much focused on preparing his army corps for battle, facilitating its success, and in some, impressing his higher-ups, namely Field Marshal Sir Douglas Haig, commander of the British forces on the Western Front. There can be no doubt, however, that Godley wanted to produce results at 30 that would win him potentially career-enhancing reputation and favour, whether during the remainder of the war or later on. None of that, great. So, we're basically at the midway point of this talk, and that's going to be the Battle of Broodsender. Behold the map. As we've established, 2nd Anzac and the New Zealand Division's roles in the October battles had a much greater importance than their limited land-based objectives suggested. Godley was well aware of this. Haig had explained to him the whole situation on the Western Front and given us his views on the general progress and state of the war. Going into the October battles, Haig was optimistic, and so was Godley, believing in both Haig's method of attack and the rationale behind it. As encapsulated by the neatly typed sets of orders flowing from Army headquarters down to his own. Godley's headquarters quickly set to issuing a series of instructions or orders for Broodseender that flowed down the infantry, the artillery, and the engineering hierarchies of his four divisions. The staff work, and we're talking type sheets of paper here, was compliant with doctrine and the practice of decentralised command. These divisions under his command included the New Zealanders, as we've discussed, the 3rd Australian Division, and the British 49th and 66th Divisions. These latter two were only temporarily attached to Godley's command, whereas the Anzacs had the misfortune of being permanently under his command. The Kiwis and Aussies would attack side by side on the 4th of October, capturing a slice of ground that would be used as a basis or foundation for future attacks at Passchendaele Ridge itself, which was part of the strategic objectives for 3rd EAP.
Okay, this is this place here is called Abraham Heights. It's on the Broodseender battlefield. You'll recall a short while ago I told you about Gordon Neill, who cradled his fatally wounded company commander. Well, that took place somewhere in that painting, which was done, I think, in 1918. Anyway, the weather and ground conditions were generally favourable before Broodseender and allowed for the vast majority of preparatory work to be completed only just within the tight 7-day operational tempo. Godley, again, as he had done at Messines, relied on his generals, Russell and Monash, the commanders of the New Zealand and Australian divisions, to do their jobs, and he simply let them get on with it. Within these two divisions, decentralised command functioned smoothly, and the staff work for the attack complied with doctrine. Planning and preparation, and in particular the engineering and artillery and infantry efforts, were facilitated by the generally acceptable weather. In short, the standard operating procedure worked well, as it had done at Menin Road and Polygon Wood and Messines, and this was ultimately borne out by results on the ground on the day. Godley's hands-off command or approach to command in the lead-up to Broodseender was not at all surprising. Environmental conditions were generally good, and he had two professional divisional commanders who knew their jobs. Based on his experiences at Messines, Godley knew this approach could work and placed store in it. He appeared to be proven correct when Broodseender was an outstanding success. Thereafter, Godley, amid a mood of widespread optimism from privates in the ground to the highest field marshals in Chateau behind the front line, Godley clung to his hands-off style of command, even as rain turned the battlefield into a morass, making a repeat of his Broodseender victory altogether more difficult to repeat. Later, after the war, one Kiwi soldier noted his impressions of the battlefield around this time, and I quote, "It is hard to imagine that 4 years ago, peaceful people tilled this same soil, that it was one of the most prosperous districts in Europe. Now, as I saw it today, well, it's simply an awful nightmare, a hideous reeking swamp, seething with living and dead things, a place that stamps itself on one's mind and memory like a red-hot iron." And that's the scene that the soldier was talking about. Purple appears very angry. In hindsight, the Battle of Broodseender, which we've talked about for a little bit, was the high point of 2nd Anzac's tour in the 3rd EAP offensive. History tells us that it went south thereafter. So now, with that in mind, we're going to delve into the pit of despair, and that is the bloody battles of Polkapel and 1st Passchendaele.
Second Army now issued orders for the Battle of Polkapel on the 9th of October. This would involve 2nd Anzac's two British divisions. The problem was the hitherto firm ground, which had been easy for infantry to negotiate, was now soaked. The operational tempo, which is the number of days between battles, in essence the amount of time that you have to prepare for one battle after the preceding one, had been accelerated from 7 days to just 4. The logistics and infrastructure networks were failing, and by that I mean the roads, the tracks, the gun pits and so on. The objectives that the infantry had to achieve lay much deeper in enemy territory, and the attack was now to take on the formidable German Flandern 1 defensive line. Problem is, Godley knew all of these difficulties. He'd been told by his subordinate officers, but he would still brook no delay in attacking up Passchendaele Ridge. His staff work reflected this outlook and ambition, but in reality, it failed to mitigate the growing list of practical and tactical obstacles that had to be dealt with in far too short a period of time. Godley's infantry, the Brits of the 49th and 66th Divisions, weren't even at the jumping off lines when the 0 hour for the battle ticked over. The artillery was bogged down, out of position, and of insufficient strength to provide the requisite supporting barrage. Godley had all of the information he needed to shift to hands-on, here's our man at the moment again, to shift to hands-on command to make sure that these vital preparations, which we've just talked about, were completed, or call for a delay so that they could be completed. But he did neither, and so consigned the attack of the 9th of October to failure long before it ever began. The Battle of Polkapel showed Godley to be inflexible and ignorant of the relationship between staff work, preparations for an attack, operational tempo, and the prevailing operational conditions. These flaws were only made worse by his personal hands-off style of command in any and every situation. Douglas Haig, Field Marshal Haig, the man that the commander of 2nd Anzac was trying to impress, was pretty annoyed when it turned out that the gains Godley had said he had made on the 9th of October turned out to be quite a bit less than he had said. That placed Godley's reputation and his credibility in question. Godley, unsurprisingly, and now clinging blindly to the generally absent post-Brutzender optimism, became even more entrenched in his desire for 2nd Anzac Corps to capture a slice of Passchendaele Ridge and also, maybe, the ruins of the village after which it was named. The campaign's architects, Haig and Plumer, embraced this optimism, even though other corps commanders, Godley's equals, were wary of the risks that this involved. Godley now brought Russell's and Menasha's divisions back into the line, and these are the New Zealand division, of course, involving our great and great-great-grandfathers and uncles. Godley promised Haig that an Australian flag would be raised over the ruins of Passchendaele after the 12th of October attack, a tacit admittance that he still planned to take a foothold on the ridge and ultimately help achieve the overall offensive strategic goals. Staff work to implement this attack, the 12th of October, now followed the familiar model. And there's a map of the battlefield. 2nd Anzac's orders and instructions, essentially repeats of those for the disastrous Polkapel battle, but requiring an advance of even greater depth, efficiently cascaded down the chain of decentralised command. Once again, though, 2nd Anzac's orders and instructions implied a high degree of inevitability that the attack would go ahead, regardless of the reality of the circumstances that it faced. But that staff work cannot in any way be reconciled with the artillery, infantry and engineering preparations that needed to be completed beforehand. This time, the operational tempo, which you'll recall is the number of days to prepare for an attack, had quickened again from 7 days before Brutzender to 4 for Polkapple, to less than 3 for First Passchendaele. All the while, the confluence of factors and obstacles which would tell against the attack's success had only continued to worsen. The artillery guns supporting 2nd Anzac remained too few, too far out of position to provide any meaningful support in the form of a preparatory bombardment or covering barrage to support the infantry. Godley knew all of this. Several of his senior officers had told him directly, but he would tolerate neither variation from timetable nor debate any of this information from his men on the spot, in spite of this being a requirement of military doctrine. Once again, Godley defaulted to his hands-off command style when the situation demanded that he take control with a proactive, flexible, and manifestly more intelligent approach. As it turned out, 1st Passchendaele was a predictable rerun of Polkapple, but this time it was the New Zealanders and Australians that paid the price for Godley's failings. However, it must be observed that at the divisional level, both Russell and Monash recognised that the confluence of negative environmental factors and the unrealistic operational tempo made a successful attack highly improbable on the 12th of October. They knew the outcome of Polkapple on the 9th of October, and so then became ever more hands-on with their own command styles within their division. Some Kiwis at 30. Monash and Russell also knew that the available time and the waterlogged ground conditions meant that their division's very best efforts to complete an acceptable level of planning and preparations would or must surely fall short. On the eve of 1st Passchendaele, the 11th of October, neither Russell nor Monash believed that the attack had much chance of success, if any at all. Regrettably, they also knew that they had no hope whatsoever of convincing an emphatic Godley, who enjoyed the support of both Haig and Plumer, to postpone the attack that their men would have to go into. Broodsinger and 1st Passchendaele showed Russell and Monash to be intelligent and responsive divisional commanders who embraced decentralised command and hands-on command, but the event showed that this level of professionalism counted for little if it wasn't matched by core command, in other words, Godley. The end result was thousands of New Zealand soldiers going into a battle essentially destined to fail before it ever began. As one soldier who would survive and go on to become an old man said, I didn't meet this guy by the way, have you ever wondered what it would feel like to know that you're about to be killed in a matter of seconds? So it was that soon after 5 a.m. on the 12th of October 1917, at 0 hour, the Kiwi infantry laboured forward through the mud, crashed through sloppy shell holes, and were soon drenched to the skin and caked in mud. They pressed on towards the intact German defences, a mixture of trenches, strong points, and intact pillboxes spitting lead at them. One German rifleman said he fired 500 bullets himself and alone at New Zealand targets. This is a painting of the battlefield on which the New Zealanders fought. German machine gun and rifle fire ripped across the Kiwi ranks. Occasionally our own artillery shells dropped short. Hundreds fell dead and wounded. The attack went to ground and stalled, and ultimately failed. As rifleman Harold Green confided in his diary, the attack was an impossible attempt. The stunt should never have been ordered under such conditions. It was absolute murder. As daylight came on, Gerald Beattie, whom I mentioned at the top end of this talk, told me of the awful sight of seeing his friends wounded or killed around him. It was worse, though, he reckoned, when German sharpshooters began picking off survivors or anyone who raised their head above the rim of a shell hole. Bill Ramage, the disciplinary case, character that I really liked, went forward He was shot in the ankle and stumbled into a shell hole, getting soaked from head to toe in the process. He recalled that he and others were pinned there for the rest of the day. All they could do was stay quiet and smoke cigarettes. In truth, this was a story replicated many times across the Kiwi battlefront. As soldiers like Bill waited for darkness to come on and hopefully crawl their way back to friendly trenches. But I'm conscious that somebody like me runs the risk of being far too harsh on a man like Godley. To that end, I think very briefly as we approach the back end of this talk, that a little bit of comparative history is actually quite useful. After Godley's 2nd Anzac Corps, the Canadians took over and became the vanguard of the 3rd EAP Offensive. There they were bid to capture the ruins of Passchendaele and a footing on Passchendaele Ridge, just as the Kiwis and Australians and Brits under Godley's command had been before them. In stark contrast to Godley, Lieutenant General Sir Arthur Currie, commander of the Canadian Corps, saw Passchendaele in purely objective terms. He altered the expectations placed on his corps to meet both its capabilities and the prevailing environmental conditions, and his ultimate success in battle reflected this. Whereas Currie's performance at 30 was manifestly intelligent, this can be seen in his decisions to slow the operational tempo, the number of days between attacks, set shallower objectives that were more realistic for his men to achieve, and consider the ground conditions when planning his push up Passchendaele Ridge. His staff work, his orders and instructions, unlike Godley's, reflected all of this. But make no mistake though, the Canadian success was costly in terms of casualties. Now I'm going to do a little bit of maths here, so just bear with me. In the two New Zealand attacks, Anzac attacks up Passchendaele Ridge on the 9th and 12th of October, 2nd Anzac Corps advanced a total of 700 yards, and I'm being charitable when I say 700 yards. That's the best possible outcome. The cost for those two attacks was 11,650 Kiwis, Aussies and Brits dead, wounded and missing. That worked out at roughly 16.6 casualties per yard of ground. By contrast, after attacking over more or less the same piece of ground, Currie's Corps advanced 2,500 yards, racking up a little over 16,000 of all casualty types, or about 6.4 Canadian casualties per yard of ground gained. The difference, 10.2 casualties per yard of ground, was the cost of Godley's failings, his numerous failings as a corps commander in charge of the New Zealand, Australian and British divisions. However, I caution that these are just numbers. They are as bald as they are prosaic. They do not, for instance, tell you what it was like to wallow in mud as red-hot shrapnel and bullets zipped about overhead and dived into the ground with a fut. They do not convey what it was like to see and hear your friends and family members grievously wounded or killed. Nor do they include the soldiers suffering from the invisible wounds of war, a number of which played out sadly in the communities of New Zealand in the decades after the First World War. And so with all of that in mind, I'd like to wind this talk up with something an old soldier, an old friend, told me about 3rd EAP. His name was Gordon Neal. I mentioned him at the top end of the talk. His ashes are buried at Anderson's Bay Cemetery in Dunedin. I still visit there every time I'm in Dunedin, actually. He was wounded on the 4th of October. His brother, whose photo was presented earlier in this talk, was killed on the 12th of October. He himself helped carry out the wounded British soldiers. As Gordon said, it was a terrible, wanton loss of life. Sheer bloody murder, one's mind turns back to the competence of those who were leading the battles. I didn't realise at any time during my service the futility of putting a man like Godley in charge. To think that people like him had the right to send thousands to their death. Flesh and blood, Gordon said, won't stand against a hail of bullets and shrapnel. No way. I know, because I've been through it. And so, in concluding, there can be very little doubt whatsoever that Godley emerges against the backcloth of the muddy and bloody Third Ypres offensive as an incompetent bungler who willingly drove his 2nd Anzac Corps, which included the New Zealanders, to the cusp of destruction. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for hearing me out. I know that was a bit difficult at times, but have a great weekend, and here is a slide of luck that will lighten the mood.
And I guess to sum that up, is why we remember them when you consider, you know, this particular battle and the casualties, you know, that resulted. That's why we say we will remember them, and that's why we hold a Remembrance Day. So, I'm sure you won't mind us answering any questions.
No, go for it. Yep.
So, questions? Richard, you're first.
Well, sort of jumping back up to the sort of strategic level of Hay, I know Passchendaele has this reputation for being almost a pointless battle, but as you pointed out, there was this goal of getting the German submarine corps, and through 1917 the German submarines were very, very effective. So Britain had a serious problem with the submarines. At the same time, the French had mutinies in their army. They had gone through the Verdun campaign the year before, and they were essentially doing the minimum necessary to hold their line, and somebody had to take an offensive against the Germans. So with that in mind, Passchendaele had a purpose, but I do take your point that it was very badly managed at the operational level.
Yeah, so the Battle of 30, I mean, its origins weren't just in 1917. They were founded, you know, somewhat earlier. Plumer had drawn up schematics, I think, as early as late 15, early 16, something like that. So it had been on the boiler, but point absolutely noted. Yeah, the French army was exhausted, particularly after 1914 and Verdun.
I hope you'll forgive me for mentioning family situation.
Not at all.
But my uncle from Palmerston North, my name's Don Stewart, Roy Stewart, my father's oldest brother. He was underage. He died on the 12th with a bullet through his head. Another Stewart from Fielding, same surname, climbed up out of the whatever hole they were in and tried to pull Roy back, and he was shot as well, and they died together. Their names are together on the wall at the Tynecott Cemetery, where I've visited, and also on the in the square here on the wall there. The interesting thing is, when I went there, I found a book in a hotel called As the Sun Goes Down. It was written, I don't know if you know that book, I've got two copies of it, but it was written with one soldier from each of the 365 days of the First World War, a story of that soldier. And it was written by three or four British authors at some, it wasn't centenary, whatever, 60 years or whatever it was. I've got two copies of that book, and that book says that my uncle was a sergeant and the other soldier was a private. My uncle was an underage private, and the other soldier was not his brother, as the story says they were. They probably told people they were brothers because they came from the same town. They went from Otago, but they came from here and Fielding. And so the stories can be incorrect, and they were chosen to represent the First World War fatalities on the 12th of October 17, just by total chance.
Well,
and when I found that book, when I saw that book, it just fell open at that date, because obviously people who visit Passchendaele look for that date. So that's just to me an interesting story of being unable to explain how that error occurred, but it is true that two boys from Palmerston North, both underage, died on that day.
Yeah, I don't think we'll ever get to the bottom of the people net and the connections that were at play on that and other days. I know there's a list of four or five families that had multiple casualties on that day, but I strongly suspect that there's more. But again, it's so hard to unpick with people moving here and there, and what a coincidence.
I'll talk to you about.
I have two questions.
Go on.
One very brief one, and one slightly longer.
Oh, yes.
Is the Godley you've mentioned here the namesake of Godley Head?
I think a connection. I think there is a connection.
But
it's actually, Godley himself had no children,
right.
But there are a number of people who claim to be children.
Okay.
So I'm always going to be a little guard my, bets.
All right. I won't
on that one.
But there are, Godley Head, I think it's Rich Levinson.
Yeah, Christchurch.
Yeah. I think it's an uncle or a cousin, but it's not him.
It's incorrect, right. Okay, thank you.
And what was the next one?
The other question is, based on your presentation, and you made you alluded.
Go on.
To
sounds interesting.
Some sort of attitude that was underlying the decisions that Godley made.
Yeah.
I know he's a stiff British authoritarian type.
Yeah.
But what was the driving force that drove him?
Well, as I noted, there's...
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, sure do. So there's a number of different opinions. Mine isn't the only one. There
right.
are those that would... my opinion is rather harsh. There are those that would be more moderate in their views. I, after reading every piece of paper that there is in New Zealand and England and Canada and Germany that I could find, I'm pretty confident my view's robust. But I do think that he was very much focused on achieving the outcome. I wouldn't say for self-serving gains entirely, that would be wrong, but I don't think he understood. I think he rather more fancied the idea of winning a battle than necessarily being able to win it himself. And when you look at the comparison of him specifically with other Corps commanders, whether Australian, whether Canadian, whether British, what you see is that at 3rd Eid, this is Godley's first major offensive as a Corps commander. Messines was kind of a one-off, if you will, before 3rd Eid. He didn't fight at the Somme as a Corps commander, so he was relatively inexperienced when you look at his bearing and the disasters that that had. I would say that Godley does go on in 1918 to kind of learn the lessons from Passchendaele that others had learned in 1915 and 16. So the Lieutenant General Curry was one of those guys. He'd had the benefit of serving on the Western Front through 1915 and 16 as a divisional and corps commander. Godley didn't have that. And for all the lessons that Gallipoli might have offered and perhaps did offer, it was a very different war to the Western Front. So I wouldn't say it was without value, but it's kind of chalk and cheese in being able to take that experience and slot it in.
The duration of the battle and the casualty rate must be an extreme stress on the general and senior commanders.
Mm.
What happened to them after the battle? Do they require site react help?
For the general?
Yes, it must be a strain. They take all that away with them.
Yeah.
Lying in sleep.
Yeah. So, I'm just racking my brains here. So there was no psychological help at all. If you're a private soldier, if your platoon or company commander was on the money, then they would recognise that and be able to help you. But as far as the generals go, there was no psychological help, and I think that Godley was economic and prosaic in his description of the casualty level to the New Zealand government. It's a subject that I think he just moved on to the next battle or next series of battles. If it caused him pause to think, it was probably at an administrative level rather than a personal level. But he hasn't left any expansive writings on that, and I wouldn't like to put words in his mouth unnecessarily.
One of the things I noticed on your map was a location that had a very strange name.
Yeah, go on.
Peter Pan.
Oh, yeah, so it's a farm. They're not friendly people. So I jumped out of a car there once to have a walk over the battlefield. And in France, you can do that, right? That's not an issue, so long as you leave it as you found it, as you would. Last Boy Scout. But no, they not in Belgium, not at all. But it's Peter Pan Farm, and it sits in exactly the same place that it is on the map. And there were all sorts of strange names for trenches and farms and locations. Often there's an alphanumeric sort of code to it, but that varies depending on where you are on the Western Front.
Yeah. Over in England, sadly, it depended on which school you went to.
Yeah.
If you went to a good school, you automatically went into the army in a high up position, regardless of what abilities you had. And that's why the Australians made a law after that they will never serve under any other person than an Australian in any war.
Yeah.
And that's a firm law in Australia.
Thanks, Mel.
Okay, regarding Godley, my thesis at the end of the year was on Swan's Island and Turmeric.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the interesting thing with that, I came to the same conclusion. He was only there at the very, very start when they were setting the thing up. He basically appointed two school teachers to the top positions and then hopped on a ship and went off with the main body and forgot about them. And it just turned into chaos because you know these people who are not suited, and especially Major Magistin, who was the common bed, turned into a bunch of bashers like in out of control school teachers.
So not to put the bash on my chums, the school teachers, heavens knows. I don't even know how I passed school, but I did. So there was the social fabric was very different then, and as many of you will know, being a teacher was considered to be a focal point of responsibility in a community. Mm-hmm. And so it followed that recruiting often allowed the professions into those ranks relatively easy and without a merit basis. That changed during the war, but it was by no means foolproof at all.
It altered for them. Major Madison got put out and was replaced by Major Blunt, who served at Gallipoli.
Yeah.
And our idea was that he knew how to command men where Madison bashed them.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, you know. There's a particular school in Wellington, and one of the principals there was a Gallipoli veteran and Western Front veteran, and had two men executed for desertion under his command and recommendation, and apparently beyond reproach, but every day he'd line his children up as if they were on a military parade. And I think they loved them just as much as the soldiers did. So they say.
All right, I'm mindful of the time, and I know that people want to get home and have dinner. So are there any sort of last substantive questions for Andrew before we bring things to a close? I think I've dropped the supple there. Andrew, round up. Certainly I think it brings to mind, as I said, why we remember them and the absolute disasters that occurred, particularly during the First World War, but in other campaigns since then. So once again, thank you all for coming along tonight and observing Remembrance Day. For those who were there this morning for the parade and service, thank you also for attending. Finally, a final thanks to Andrew for the presentation.